Good afternoon. If you want to follow along, I'm reading from Romans chapter 6, verses 20 through 23. Romans 6, 20 through 23. For when you were slaves of sin, you were free in regard to righteousness. What fruit did you have then in the things of which you are now ashamed? For the end of those things is death. But now, having been set free from sin and having become slaves of God, you have your fruit. You have your fruit to holiness and the end, everlasting life. For the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus our Lord.
I was 10 years old when I smoked my first joint. It was the best thing that ever happened in my life. I knew at that moment, across the street from my house in a pup tent, what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. Everything about my life seemed incomplete before that moment. I wanted to get high, I wanted to be high, and I wanted everything that went with it. And I set about to do that. About killed me. Through the grace of God, I was able to survive through things I probably should not have survived through. And I've been restored to some manner, at least, of health. And depending upon you, when you ask my wife, some level of mental stability. This is my story. This is not a sermon, by the way. You'll figure that out. I will apologize. I will try and keep it as PG as possible. I am a minister, but these are real things. The things I'm going to tell you about are not PG, then they are real. So why tell your story? Why do this? Why have this series? Well, this is a five-set series that we're going to do through tomorrow. Please come back if you can. The only way to start a series on alcoholism is by telling your story. I met a young man who's in the program a little earlier. The way that any alcoholic finds out that he's an alcoholic and that he wants to be sober is by hearing another alcoholic tell their story. And then, oops, I hit the wrong button. All right, there we go. My apologies. When an alcoholic tells their story, what happens is another alcoholic hears that story and they go, aha! I know what that's like. I've been there. I've felt that. I've thought that. I've done that. Somebody else is like me. Now you're telling me you're sober. Are you happy? I promise you, alcoholic wants to know that. Alcoholic wants to know that because you want them to give up the thing in their life, their God, their lover, their most important thing, the thing that they will forsake all other things for are drugs and alcohol. So this is my story. It may not apply to you. You may sit there and think, well, this is the worst thing I've ever been to. This doesn't matter to me at all. It may not. I would imagine, though, that if my story does not matter to you, what we'll deal with somewhere around 5:15-ish, will. Because I guarantee you everyone in this audience has someone that they know that's an alcoholic or an addict. Guarantee you. Guarantee everyone in this audience is affected by it in some way, shape, form, or fashion. So, this is my story. Every alcoholic can tell you the first time they took their drug of choice. Everyone. Because the light goes off. You become complete. There's something missing in your life that drugs and alcohol fill in a way that nothing else can. People will describe it differently, a warm feeling, a different sensation, a feeling of security. 10 years old, I knew what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. Drank alcohol soon thereafter. I was hanging out with people that were older than I was. I was big. I was this tall in the eighth grade, so I hung out with older kids. I played ball with older kids. I hung around older kids. So as I began to do that, by the time I got to about the seventh grade, which is junior high where I'm from, I'm from Blytheville, by the way. Beautiful, beautiful place, Lily of the Valley. So many people are moving into Blytheville right now, they can't keep them out. Seventh grade, junior high in Blytheville. That's when I began to have availability of having marijuana on a regular basis. Somewhere between my seventh and eighth grade year, I became a daily smoker. And between the time that I was in my seventh or eighth grade year until the time I got sober, I smoked dope every day. It's what I wanted to do. And everything else became subservient to that. Brother read the verse from Romans chapter 6. Bob Dylan has a great song called "You Gotta Serve Somebody." It may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you gotta serve somebody. The great lie about drugs and alcohol, or for that matter, sexual immorality or all the other sins of the flesh, is that they offer freedom from those bonds of being a kid. We all hate our parents, don't we? Just me? Preachers, parents, and elders are just trying to ruin our fun. Is this not right? 13-year-old Jason Sage, I see some young people here. Thank you for being here. I just thought that you old people were not capable of having fun anymore and were set out to ruin mine. I was pretty sure that's what was going on here. And I didn't want to hear it, and I had been high, and I liked it. And I did not jump off a building and die. One of the things about being my age is the propaganda of the news media of the time about using drugs was that was what was going to happen to you. You would smoke one joint and immediately jump off the highest building in town and die. Well, when that doesn't happen, guess what? I begin to guess about every other thing you've told me too. Don't you lie to your teenager. Sorry, this is a bonus sermon. You tell them the truth. So I figured since everything else you told me was a lie, that maybe you were wrong about this. Maybe it was okay. Maybe it was something I could do with impunity. And I began to do it as often as possible. Had a friend of mine in Arkansas back in the late 70s, early 80s, when you were 14 years old, you could get a driver's license to go to work, or if your parents worked and couldn't drive you to school. Good friend of mine named David got his driver's license at 14, and we were off and running. My daily schedule from that point until the time I got sober was I smoked at least one joint in the morning before school. I smoked at least one joint and drank 3, 4, 5, 6 beers at lunch. I smoked another joint, and if there was alcohol available, I did that after school. Sometimes I would do it before football practice. Sometimes I would do it after football practice or basketball practice. Then in the evening, I would smoke dope. And then if I could get out of the house for any reason whatsoever, we would smoke dope, drink beer that night. Every day of my life, that's what I did. I had to lie a lot. Guess what I was not telling my parents? Guess what I was not telling my preacher? Guess what I was not telling the elders? Guess what I was not telling everybody? That my entire life was a lie. Everything I did every day was something I couldn't tell the people who loved and cared about me I was doing. So I began to use all the time. I would imagine there are people in this room who did the same thing or have a very similar experience. Don't be shocked by it. Parents, if you have kids at age 15, they know this kid. They know me. They have Jason Sage as their buddy at school. I digress. So I began to use. I was a pretty good athlete. I was not going to the NFL. I was not going to the NBA, despite what I thought. I had an uncle who was 6'5". I was pretty certain I was going to be 6'6" and be the starting tight end for the Pittsburgh Steelers. There was very little doubt in my mind about this. I stopped growing. It was God's little cruel joke on me. 6'1" does not cut it in the league. Also slow. It's another story. But here's what happens. One of the things about drug addiction and alcoholism that I think is universal is the economy of it. People do not give you marijuana. People do not give you Valium. People do not give you LSD. People do not give you cocaine. People do not give you alcohol. I don't know why. They don't. So you have to get it. Well, for those of you who have any knowledge of what I'm talking about, you think about 5, 6 joints a day. How much is that? Does anybody know? This is not church. Does anybody know? Somebody tell me how much that is a day. At least. That was in the 80s. It's a quarter. It's a quarter ounce. My quarter ounce was my get by. That's how much I had to have every day to function. That's the pack of cigarettes for a smoker, right? If you're a good, I don't know how many people smoke anymore, but back in the day, if you were a good cigarette smoker, you had to at least smoke a pack a day. That's what you had to get by. Well, for me, I had to have a quarter ounce of marijuana. That was somewhere around $25-$30 early on. By the time I quit, it was around $40. My best understanding is it's somewhere around $40 or $50, depending on how good it is today. Well, in 1979, 1980, how does a 13, 15-year-old young man come up with $30 a day? You don't. So what do? What do I do? A deal. I don't know who said it, but you're right. If that's not what you said, you're right anyway. You deal. You get somebody to front you an ounce of pot, which is roughly $100 if I pay it back. Dealer will sell you an ounce of pot for $100. I can sell four quarters of it for $40 a piece and make $20, theoretically. What happens when you give dope-smoking Jason Sage an ounce of pot? He doesn't sell it all. He smokes it. Then I end up owing the dealer. Okay? This is why your teenage kid who's a drug addict and alcoholic steals from you. This is why your college-age kid needs money all the time. This is why your husband or your uncle or whoever it is needs money from you all the time, because they got to hit a mark. And this is before you find cocaine or OxyContin or whatever it is. So at that age, you begin to deal, because you can only tell your parents you're eating so much pizza at your friend's house. Okay? You can only tell them you're going to do so much and get $10 here and $5 there, and you and your buddies come back together and you spend $10 here, $5 there, you got to get more. So you begin dealing on a pretty regular basis. And what happens is you are serving your addiction, because you got to have that quarter ounce a day, every day, and that's not including beer or that's not having a good time. That's just getting by. That's not beer. That ain't going to the club. That ain't Valium. That ain't cocaine. You kind of tell where I am. Those are my drugs of choice. The thing that's going on right now is OxyContin. By the way, is there any doctors, any medical people that are, I'm fixing to say something's going to hurt your feelings. Doctors are the worst thing in the world for an alcoholic. You know what doctors, you know what the medical industry has done in this world? They've brought heroin back. You know why they brought heroin back? Because they told people and marketed this for years that OxyContin is not addictive. That is stupid, and it's a lie. But your kid is stealing from your cabinet. Your kid has back, all right, let me tell you something else. 40, 50, 60-year-old dude has back pain, and he's going to the pain clinic. There are two things that are a joke in this world right now. I hope I'm not hurting anybody's feelings, but pain clinics and low T centers. I hope no one owns one of those. You're probably like making a lot of money and don't care. However, I digress. So you begin to deal. When you begin to deal, things start breaking down in your life. You have the pressure of using these drugs and alcohol on a regular basis. So you have to have more money. You have to have more time. Do I want to take my free time to study? Do I want to take my free time to go to football practice or to basketball practice or do any of that? No, I do not. What do I want to do? I want to get high. Anything that gets in the way of that, I try to remove. By the time I was, I don't know if my dad knows this, I think I went to jail first when I was 12. I'm not sure about this. My dad may be able to tell you. He's here somewhere. 12 years old. Friend of mine, my dad doesn't know all this. 12 years old, me and my buddy from across the street are high because the sun came up. We don't have a car yet, so we're riding around on bicycles in Blytheville, Arkansas, high and enjoying life. We decide it would be a good idea to go to the football field and steal the yard markers and put them on our bikes like BMX bikes with the numbers. I don't know if people know that about that anymore. Well, then we decided what would be a really good idea is to climb on top of the high school. Point of order. Don't do that It's illegal. Criminal trespassing is the charge, just in case you want to know. But you haven't lived until Church of Christ, raised in the church, Jason Sage, has to call his deacon daddy at 2 a.m. to tell him to come get him out of jail. It ain't fun. It's not fun when you're on top of the high school and the cops pull up. My parents began to wonder about me at that point. Now, up to that point, I was a relatively successful child. I was relatively intelligent. I had good grades. I was a good athletic kid. I was relatively friendly, relatively successful. I had been baptized. Things seemed to be going well. And I'm in jail. The thing that you'll find out about drug addicts and alcoholics, and that term is interchangeable, by the way. If I say alcoholic, I mean addict. If I say addict, I mean alcoholic. It's all the same thing. Nothing really slows you down. You would think some of these things would slow you down. They won't. My parents found pot on me the first time, I think, when I was 14 or 15. I don't really remember the age. What do? You lie. It's somebody else's. Parents, tell me if you've heard this before. It's the first time. It's the last time. That'll never happen again. Whatever. It wasn't the first time or the last time. It didn't quit. Somewhere around my junior year, we ran out of pot. What do you do when you run out of pot? You try and get somebody to front you some pot so you can have some pot. You can come up with a little beer money, but pot's hard to come up with. That $30 a day, that $30, $40 a day is hard to crack in 1981, 82. So I went and found somebody who fronted me a quarter pound of pot. Quarter pound? Yeah, there we go. Thank you. I love you, by the way. Thank you for being here for me. Quarter pound of pot is a pretty good amount of pot. That's more than you can carry in your underpants. You're laughing. I promise you, if dope smoking guy is here tonight, it's in his sock or his underwear right now. Or his car. But he may have to have it close by. He may have a one-hitter in his sock. So I get a guy to front me a quarter pound of pot. A quarter pound of pot's $400. I don't know in 1982, if you were 16 years old, how quickly you could come up with $400. It might as well have been $1 million for me. So I got this pot fronted to me, and what have I got to do? I got to sell it because these are serious people. These are people I had never dealt with before. So I bagged it all up in quarters, and I hid it in a good spot. And I do not know if my dad knows this. He may. I hid it in an old refrigerator freezer that had been on our deck for years. It was filled with trash and hadn't been opened or looked at in years. $400 worth of pot in this refrigerator. My dad wakes me up on a Saturday morning and tells me we're cleaning up the back porch. First of all, I wasn't excited about that under any circumstances. I was an addict. I was still a normal teenager. I had to help my father strap together that locking chest upright freezer with $400 worth of pot in it and help him haul it off. This was not a good experience. We hauled it off to some water-filled dump out toward the state line. I'm sure this was illegal. We probably could be arrested just for this. And I had to help him unload that freezer full of that pot into this slime. It was a dump that was filled with water, 6-8 feet deep. Well, I'm in a panic. I'm in a panic the whole time because the kind of people who front you $400 worth of pot are serious people. This was around Thanksgiving, and I tell you why. It's probably why Daddy had to clean up the deck, come to think of it. You haven't lived until you are in your house with every relative you know who's there for Thanksgiving. And a woman you've never met before in your life of around 35 years old shows up with a gun in her handbag knocking on the front door telling you that they are going to shoot you. My Aunt Donna answered the door. I'll never forget that. People talk about things getting real. Things got real. Think about that for just a moment. I'm in the house. Everybody's there. She answers the door. Jason, there's somebody here to see you. This gal clearly was not family. She clearly was not my girlfriend. And I go to the door and I step out on the porch and she shows me that gun and she tells me I will have her pot or her money that night or else. Honey, who was at the door? Well, that sent a series of activities. I had to find an excuse to leave the house. Got a friend of mine to take me to this dump, and we got an inner tube. and we set out on that inner tube. I set out on that inner tube with a stick to go get that freezer, which is floating out in this, let's say, water. And it was strapped together, so I had to get the straps off of it, dangling over this stuff. And when I opened, finally got it open, and opened the handle, and the refrigerator popped over. And the pot started coming up because it was sealed in baggies. And I'm grabbing this stuff, take it back to them. Never met these people before. Knew they were serious, by the way. Knew they were serious before I ever messed with them. Walked in the door with about probably 3 ounces worth of soaking wet pot. $40 maybe, I don't know. Walk into this little house. When I walked in the door, the lady that I mentioned is sitting right here in a chair, proceeds to point a gun where my jockey underwear would be. And there's a man behind the door with a club. They're not happy with me. I'm panicking. Here's what you want. The pot had changed color from the water, and they didn't believe it was their pot. They thought I was trying to trade some sensimilla from some dirt weed. This woman held a gun on me, standing still with this other man behind me for 30 minutes or so, as they dried this pot in an oven so that they could smoke it to prove to themselves that it was really theirs. And they finally let me go. Did I stop? Of course not. Somewhere along that time, I remember having my first real blackout. I drove around in a car. Just assume the rest of this story, I'm smoking pot every day. I'm not going to tell you that. Morning, noon, night, mid-afternoon, mid-evening, late at night, quarter ounce a day from the time I'm 13 to the time I got sober. Just fit that into the story. We're riding around, drinking, doing whatever. I get so drunk that I pass out. My buddies tell me that I threw up something like 7 times. And I wake up the next morning. Have you ever woke up and your arm is asleep? You know, you kind of lay on your arm or something like that and it's asleep. I was laying on a bed straight out. My legs were not crossed, but my legs felt asleep. I had nearly killed myself with alcohol poisoning. And when I woke up, I couldn't get my legs to stop feeling like they were asleep. For a long time, you could take a pin and put it in my left heel and I wouldn't know it. I don't know what the medical condition for that was, but I almost killed myself with alcohol and drugs. One of the reasons that I remember that instance is that was one of the few days that I did not drink or smoke dope that day, because it was a big deal. Even at that point, I thought, this will teach me a lesson. I'm not drinking again. When you wake up like that for a moment or two, you ain't drinking again. It occurs to you. And then you think, well, I'm not drinking Old English 800 because you're a genius. And then by the next day, what? It won't hurt me. I'm back and running. None of this was very good for my school life or my athletic life. By the time I got to my junior year, things really began falling off. I was relatively smart. I took the ACT as a sophomore. I made a 25 on it. I took it as a junior, high as a kite, made a 28 with a 31 and a 32 in the sciences. Okay? I was not an idiot. I had colleges sending me letters. I had free scholarships anywhere I wanted to go in the world. At that time, a 25 would get you into any state school in the Southeast, free tuition for the whole time. I had been an all-star football player and basketball player in my junior high years. In my high school years, I wasn't even playing. My grades are falling off. 28 ACT with a 32 and 31 on your sciences should not be flunking things, yet I was. Why? I'm high all the time. I ain't got time for grades. I'm too busy getting high. And really the straw, I think, that warned my parents something was up was I began to skip football practice. If you've ever been on a football team, how many guys that skip summer practice get to play? Nobody. Well, that's what I began to do. Somewhere in there, my parents found pot on me again. I can't tell you the pressure that living that life puts on you. Being a teenager is hard as it is. Being a teenager who's going through those kind of things and lying about everything that you do is even harder. And I had put my mother and my father through so much. They were respectable people. They were good people. They did not beat me. They did not secretly drink. They were not charlatans. My dad was a deacon in the church. They were respected people. At that point in my life, I didn't know how I was going to go forward. My dad used to own a .38 pistol, and I knew where it was. At 16 years old, I sat on the couch for a long time thinking about using it because I didn't know where my life was going. I wasn't playing football. My grades were going in the tank. I had betrayed my parents in a way that I never thought I could get back. And I couldn't face my daddy. The only thing that kept me from pulling that trigger was the thought of my mother finding my body. I love my mother. So I lied again, got through it, kept on. I almost flunked out of my senior English class. I told my mom I was going to the library to work on some term paper that had to be done. Of course I did not. She knew, and my mother was a teacher. She knew a lot of the teachers. She knew I had to have that term paper. I wasn't going to pass. I wasn't going to graduate. She found me driving around getting high, pulled up behind me in the truck, and got me to pull over. When I had the verse read earlier about slavery, sin is slavery. Drug addiction is slavery. You've got something you've got to do every day or your life falls apart. That's slavery. My life was falling apart. My parents were very, very tired of me by this point. I did somehow graduate. And my dad kicked me out of the house, as well he should have, a week after I graduated high school. I mean, how many times can you find pot on your kid? How many times? I mean, come on. They kicked me out of the house. I ended up going to Murfreesboro for a while. I have a good cousin named Daryl. Daryl never did use drugs. He drank. Daryl had a girlfriend that the only thing he didn't like for his girlfriend to do was smoke pot. Well, of course, when I came to town, guess what she and I did? We found a way to smoke some pot. Get high, take a couple of Valium. Her mom had Valium, thumbs up chainsaw. Nothing better than some blue Valium in the old medicine cabinet. Some blue Valium, a six-pack of beer, a couple of joints, you are feeling good. Daryl kicks me out, so I got no place to be. My parents kicked me out of the house. Daryl kicked me out of the house. I go back through. I'm driving from Murfreesboro, end up in Jackson, Tennessee. A couple of friends of mine who have an apartment, have a couple of jobs, and have a lot of pot, have a lot of pills. One of them had been in the Army, and he had been paralyzed at one time from the waist down, and the Army had given him so many pills, we didn't even know what some of them were. He had a shoebox full of stuff. So we began plowing through that. Had a roof over my head, all the pot I could smoke and all the pills I could take, alcohol, women, had a pool there. I will just say this. If you were my age back then and you were a female, you didn't want to hang around with me because I did not have your best interests at heart. I was a predator and I was successful. I'll just say that. So, we begin to do that. Eventually, we run out of money because we are going through, we found cocaine by now, and we are going through money in epic waves. We run out of money, and we have no money to pay the rent. So here the three of us are. We're out of dope. We're out of beer. We don't have rent money. We tried several schemes to make money. No one would front us any more pot, which was probably a good idea on their part. So what happens is Steve goes in for a job interview. Steve had been semi-respectable, had a manager position with several restaurants. He goes into a business to apply for a job, and when the guy goes to leave to use the bathroom or excuse himself for a moment, he leaves and he has his payroll checks sitting on the desk. Steve helped himself to one. We typed it up, and I tried to go cash it. Point of order, don't do that. There is no difference between typing up a check that says $1,200 in my name and I sign the back of it and handing the teller a note that says, please give me $1,200 or I will shoot. In the eyes of the law, they are the same thing. You're trying to rob the bank. We get caught. We know it. We're running. Steve and Ronnie get arrested while I'm watching. I had a girlfriend at the time. I was in another apartment. I watched them get arrested, and the cops walk right by me. For some reason, they didn't recognize me. I was on the run for about 4 or 5 days. That girlfriend ratted me out. Actually, her roommate ratted me out. I'm on the run, and they finally arrest me. And they take me to jail, and I'm guilty. Felony guilty. Three charges. One thing police officers are good at is multiplying charges. If you've done something, you did something while getting in the car, getting out of the car, going into the store, that's what they do. They throw like 13 charges at you. Hope they get you on one, you might plead down to another. Sorry, that's the way the world works. I'm guilty. Needless to say, I don't call my parents. They've already kicked me out of the house. I mean, I've already ended my relationship with them. My fault, not theirs. I'm in the Madison County Jail for 15 days. I don't know how long you've been in jail for before. Some of you may have been in penitentiary for long periods of time. Very, very possible. I don't know what you were doing the summer of your senior year, but I was in the Madison County Jail I did not know what to do. I didn't know who to call. I didn't know where to go. I'd already made enemies of everybody in my life. I'd already worn my parents out. I'd already worn my good friend, my cousin Daryl, out. I'd worn out all my friends in my life. This is the history of an alcoholic or a drug addict, by the way. You just ruin every relationship in your life until you have nobody left. Got to the point where we were going to have our hearing. I had a lawyer. We were going to have our hearing, and this was serious stuff. This was state penitentiary. I was guilty, 7 years minimum. That's on one charge. That's what I was looking at. Finally called Daryl, my cousin, and he called my parents. And they came and got me. Luckily for me, the state of Tennessee was under a court order for overpopulation in its state prison system. So they invented something called pretrial diversion. Anybody know what pretrial diversion is? Pretrial diversion is this. We're not going to send you to our penitentiary because really we're trying to kick people out of our penitentiary right now. We're going to take your case and we're going to put it on hold over here. And if you're not arrested for anything else after 3-4 years, I don't remember the period of time, then this will go away. However, if you get arrested for anything other than a speeding ticket, you remember playing pinball and you'd have that extra ball up here and then all of a sudden it would come back into play? Well, that court case would come back into play and you would be tried on it. Did any of that stop me? Nope. I got high in jail. My parents reluctantly allowed me to live at home for a while, I guess just because they had no answer. And I remember going, I don't know if my dad remembers this or not, I remember going to a lunch meeting with a guy at, I believe, the Ramada Inn. He was a drug and alcohol treatment counselor. I didn't know such a thing existed. What I did not know was I was being evaluated. I met all the criteria. They sent me away. I had a scholarship. I could have gone anywhere I wanted. I had chosen Ole Miss because I had gone to Ole Miss as a junior high student to go to basketball camp, Bob Weltlich basketball camp. I liked it there because the girls were the most beautiful thing I had ever seen in my life. I had not met my wife at that point. It was also far away from Blytheville. Why? Because I wanted to do what I wanted to do. And I wanted to enjoy myself. Well, my parents had a stipulation. There was one thing that my scholarship did not pay for, and that was food. So my parents held that over my head. They said, "We will not pay for your meal plan to go to the University of Mississippi unless you go to treatment." Duh! Foiled. Now, I didn't know what treatment was. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I didn't know what a drug addict was, but I was pretty sure I didn't need any of that. I just needed more pot, pills, booze, whatever. Cocaine. But I went because you gotta go. You know anybody in your family that's been to treatment? Guarantee it's probably a similar situation. Not all the time, but most of the time. The person gets in a bind and they got to go. So I went, got out. I had to stay an extra week. If those of you know about treatment, they say 28 days, but if you're a little hard-headed like me, if you don't go along with the program, you get to stay an extra week. I stayed an extra week. We ended up going to Ole Miss, and I stayed dry for maybe 30 days. I want to tell you one more story because my dad is here. I don't know if this is a good thing or not, but something I have never forgotten. When we left our house to fly, my dad's a pilot, to fly to Chattanooga, where the treatment center was, my 7 years younger brother was playing basketball in the front yard. I felt like I was betraying him. I was betraying him. I will never forget that. As long as I live. I have a letter at home that he wrote me when I was in treatment. Wishing that I would come back home. And play basketball with him. In AA, they tell us we don't regret our past. I regret that. My brother's not a Christian. He never has been a Christian. Sorry. Here's where I was going. I thought my daddy was going to kill us in a plane. I don't know. You can't imagine. Maybe you can. The pressure on that relationship. I had embarrassed him. I hadn't been talking that long. I had ruined everything they had ever worked for in my life. And I had put my mother and my father through so much. There's more to this story than just me. But I thought that I had put my parents to the edge of their ability to withstand it. And it was just my dad and I in a plane. And I thought multiple times that he was going to just kill us both. I don't know if that ever ran through your mind. Sorry, that was a little selfish on my part. Went to treatment. Stayed, got out, went to Ole Miss. Parents let me have the meal ticket, so I'm back in business. I stayed dry for maybe 30 days, really just because I didn't know what to do. I start using again, and I'm right back at it. One thing you'll find out about an alcoholic, no matter how long they stay dry or no matter how long they go without alcohol or drugs, when they go back, it's just the same. The sickness is still there. I didn't even go to class after about a month. I just was getting high. Somehow got some extra money. I think I had like an extra scholarship come through and pay for something that my parents had already paid for, and they gave me like a $1,200 check. Awesome. Quarter pound and an eight ball, by the way. Full scholarship, by the way. As someone who's still paying for student loans after I went back and went to college, I never forget that. Flunk out, and again, I've got to tell my parents another lie about why their son is failing in life. So I come up with something. I come home. They let me back in the house. I have no idea why. By this point, they're in contact with the program, by the way. My mother is in Al-Anon. They have family week at the treatment center, so they're introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. They began to figure things out. Kept a radio job, worked a radio job for a few months. Was doing a morning disc jockey, going in at 5 in the morning. A friend of mine, we had a lot of coke. When you have a lot of coke, what do you do with a lot of coke? You do a lot of coke. It seemed reasonable to us to go mudding at 3 or 4 in the morning, and we got stuck. And we're just blasted on coke sitting there at 7 o'clock in the morning when I realized I was supposed to have been at work 2 hours ago. I just didn't bother to go back. Believe it or not, that was not the final straw yet. My parents found another quarter pound of pot on me because it was Tuesday. You haven't lived until you've had your father say, let's go take this back where you got it. Mm-hmm. I thought I was getting shot. I'm telling you, I was pretty sure we were getting shot. But we didn't. They kicked me out of the house. From that point until December of that year, I had a motorcycle, and that's it. I had nowhere to live. I had no other options. I didn't really work a job. I slept under bridges. I crashed in people's houses. If I got lucky and there was an all-night party, that's where I stayed. If I had convinced a young lady that she needed to spend some time with me and she had a roof over her head, that's where I was for 6 months or so. I wasn't functioning very well. Living with just a motorcycle in the middle of December is not a great plan. Finally ended up with all my possessions in a black plastic bag. Every friend I knew at that latest bunch of friends that I had kicked me out. And my poor sweet cousin Daryl, who I love with all my heart, came and got me again. Let me live in his house, just don't do drugs. It wasn't long before what? I was doing coke with some friend he knew, and on and on and on. Got kicked out again. At that point, I lived in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. I'm selling cars for a living. I worked for a guy in a little car lot, and he lets me drive some trade-in that he's got. For a while, I drove like a 78 B210 with four different wheels on them. I drove a 77 Lincoln, like the two-door Cougar thing. Drove that for a while, and that's what I lived in. I lived in these cars I didn't own with license plates on them that weren't mine. I did not have a driver's license at that point. And I slept in parks. And I slept behind churches. And I took baths in swimming pools. Still not an alcoholic. Still not a drug addict. One of the things you need to realize about your alcoholic or drug addict friend or relative that you have is it's everything else but the drugs and alcohol. It's everything else. I don't have enough money. I don't have enough time. So-and-so is not nice to me. If I had a better job, if I had a better situation, if this. Everything in the world is the problem but drugs and alcohol. Why is that? Because that's your lover. That's your God. That's the number one thing in your life. That's the one thing you can't live without. Will you live without your family? Yes, you will. Will you live without your girlfriend or your boyfriend? Yes, you will. Will you live without a house? Yes, you will. Will you live without a job? Yes, you will. Will you live without cocaine, Valium, beer, and marijuana, or insert your favorite thing here? No, you will not. If it means you have to steal, if it means you have to deal, if it means you have to do whatever it is, if it means you have to lie, you will do it. During that period of time, one of the things that occasionally would happen for me is I would make a lot of money on a car sale. I remember one in particular. I had somehow put together enough money to get about a $200 apartment. It was swanky. Had a $200 apartment that, of course, I was a month behind on because, right? I made over $800 on a car deal. This is 1986-ish. Now, it doesn't take much of a genius to realize that's 3 months of rent plus $200. As I'm selling this car, I've already got the money spent. I'm thinking, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go pay 3 months worth of rent, so I don't have to worry about that anymore. I still got $200. What is that? Come on. That's a gram of cocaine and an ounce of pot. Thank you. Nice job. By the time I get to the car, I'm thinking, you know, I can just pay 1 month's rent, and then I've got a quarter pound of pot and an eight ball. Now we're having fun. By the time I get to the apartment, I'm not spending anything on rent. Because I need nice clothes so I can get out to the club, and I need a cover charge, and I need a little money in my pocket to go with my eight ball and my quarter pound. Because, hey, I got a nice set of clothes and I'm at the bar. Ladies, beware. I'm going to say nice things to you. I literally have to sneak in the back door of my apartment to get my clothes. With 4 months rent in my pocket. That's why your alcoholic and drug addict friend can't run their life. Because that's the way we think. That's the way we operate. That's not a real successful plan. My daughter takes a little economics class in school. That's not the way they teach it. Needless to say, that plan didn't work very well. I ended up out of that apartment and homeless again. Finally, this friend of mine who will remain nameless, who's a car dealer, has a friend of his that he knows who knows how to get a kilo worth of cocaine and a bale of pot. He needs somebody to ride down to Florida with him and make sure the deal goes right. I'm not doing anything. I'm homeless. I don't have a job. I've been fired from lots of jobs. Just insert that into the story somewhere. We'd be here all night if I told you the whole thing. So we go to Florida. Things go bad. I mean this very sincerely, to this day, I don't know what happened. All I know is that the guy that I was with was supposed to go meet the person with the coke and the pot and with Tony's money. And he disappeared off the face of the planet, the car with him. The car was reported stolen. It was never found. He was never found. I really don't know what happened. I had convinced some young lady down there that she needed to let me live with her because, hey, it was Tuesday. The problem with that was her father is the person who owned the trailer she was living in, and he came back from vacation. I had a talent for finding myself having guns pointed at me. So here we go again. I got two guys with shotguns telling me I'm no longer welcome there. And I wasn't. He takes me to downtown Panama City and turns me loose at the bus station and tells me he doesn't care where I go. And yet again, everything I own is in a plastic bag. Not a drug addict, by the way, at this point. Not ready to give up. And I end up in the Panama City Mission. Here's the way missions work. You can stay there for a few days, but you can't just move in. They'll give you a certain number of days, and then you got to go. And you can't stay there all day. You can be there from, let's say, 9 to 5, then you have to get out. Then you can come back to eat breakfast at around 7. Then you can come back to eat dinner at around 6. You got to get out again, and you can come back in at 9, and you can't leave. So here I am, barely 21 years old, everything I own in a plastic bag, sitting in June in Panama City, Florida, in an industrial park. Because why? I'm homeless. You might say, but Jason, why don't you call somebody? Ain't nobody want anything to do with me. And nobody returning my calls. My girlfriend, that at the time I had been my girlfriend for about a year, actually was in Panama City at the time and refused to even bring me back to Nashville. I was a winner. So I hauled everything I owned in a black plastic trash bag from the mission to this rundown, dilapidated industrial park, and I would sit there and I would look at the pigeons and I would sit out in the sunshine. And I would wait for the time to go by, and I didn't have a clue. The guy that had sent us down there didn't want anything to do with us. He was pretty sure the FBI was on our trail. He wouldn't even answer my phone calls. My parents had already kicked me out of the house so many times it's hard to keep count, justifiably. They had gotten into Al-Anon and knew not to enable, so they weren't bringing me back. My poor cousin had finally had enough of me. When You ever heard of somebody being so bad off that they wouldn't spit on you if you were on fire? That's where I was in life. I finally called. I think you had 4 days in the mission, and then the fifth day they would give you, if you had something, they would give you a fifth day. The fourth day was a Sunday, and I remember that because some nutty guy with a guitar came in to do chapel service. Well, to stay in the mission, you had to go to chapel service. And this guy, bless his heart, I wish I could remember his name, tells the story of the prodigal son. And I just cried the whole time. I knew what I had to do. God was speaking to me in that moment. There's no doubt in my mind. There was only one person that would take my phone call, and that was my mom and dad. And I called. They weren't thrilled, by the way. My dad would not as much as send me a bus ticket to get from Panama City to Nashville until he made sure that I could not cash it. Wise on his part. This was not, it did not go like the story in the Bible, by the way. When I called, there was no feast. That's not the way the call went. He was not looking and welcoming me with open arms. It was more along the lines of, what is it? Why are you calling me? No, you cannot have money. Listen, right, by the way, right. Right then, right now. I think I had to call 2 or 3 times. This was payphone days. Probably collect calls. I finally convinced him to give me a bus ticket back. I'm not kidding about the whole made sure I couldn't cash it part. And I ended up on a bus from Panama City. I had nowhere else to go. My time was up. This was it. I wasn't even homeless in the mission. I was fixed to be homeless. No nothing. No job, no car, no gun, no boat, no motorboat, not a single luxury. It wasn't a very good Gilligan's Island. Sends me a bus ticket and I go back. I'm crying the whole time, by the way, because I'm just at the end of my rope. First step of Alcoholics Anonymous is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives were unmanageable. Guess what? To say that my life was unmanageable was a easy thing to say. Powerless over alcohol, I wasn't down with. Powerless over marijuana, I really wasn't down with. Powerless over cocaine, a little easier to admit. So I end up on a bus. And in June 1987, I had a one-hitter in my possession that had nothing in it, or so I thought. Bus changed stations in Birmingham, and I got that one-hitter out, and I dug that thing, and I probably just dug wood out of the side of it. And I took about one half hit out of that one-hitter, and thank God, that's the last time I've had drugs or alcohol in my life. It wasn't my plan. Most alcoholics and drug addicts who get sober don't ever think, you know what I want to do is give up the one thing I love for something else. You get sick and tired of being sick and tired. And someone comes to you and they say, this will work. You become willing to listen. I would have stood on my head in the corner for 30 minutes a day if I thought it was going to make my life better at that point. And I mean that sincerely. What people told me to do was don't drink, don't drug, and go to meetings. They said it worked for them, and it worked for me. And through the grace of God, I've been sober this whole time, one day at a time.
Everything that I have and am is due to that. Everything. Because I am powerless over drugs and alcohol. One drink is never enough. One is too many, 20 is never enough. Now, please note, I had gone to treatment in 1984. So for 3 years, nothing. I had been forced at one time to go to meetings because you had to get people off your back, right? When you're an addict, you got to get people off your back. Occasionally you need money. Occasionally you get in trouble. What do you need? You need them off your back so you can go get high. So one of the ways that you do that is telling them, oh, I'll go to meetings now. So I went for a little bit. I learned things, and the rest, I promise you from this point on, the rest of what we talk about, Lord willing, will apply to everybody in the room, not just the few. I learned things in Alcoholics Anonymous that I should have learned from the Bible, that I should have learned in church, that I should have learned from my preachers and my Bible class. I learned them the hard way, and I learned them in reverse, and I learned them to be true, because when you are an alcoholic and you're trying to get sober, you have to have faith. I mean faith. Because if I didn't believe for a moment that what I was doing wasn't going to make me better, I would not have done it. But people told me if I did these simple things, it would get better. I did those simple things, and it got better. And I found out that one day at a time, that don't drink, don't drug, go to meetings, turn your will and your life over to the power of God, that those things worked. Not just worked in a kind of will get me to heaven, check off a list way, but I mean life-changing, life-saving. How long has that been? Somebody with better than math with me. That would be 20, I'm embarrassed that I know, it'd be 28 years this year, is that right? 28. Yeah, it'd be 28, Lord willing, in June. It'd be 28 years. My kids have never seen me drink. My wife has never known me like that. I know people who've known me all my life who've never known that me, who couldn't imagine that me. But that's who I am. I'm not ashamed of it. You can't be ashamed of it. You can't hide from it. I had hid all of my life. I had been guilty all of my life. I hadn't been able to look anybody in the eye in my life and tell them what I did for the last 4 hours. I'm not that way anymore. Love you. Listen, we're going to take a break. Terry, yes? We're going to take a break, and we're going to talk about the family and the alcoholic. Please stay. Thank you for coming, first of all. Thank you for coming. The rest of this will be a little more coherent, I promise. And we will talk a little bit about the family and lay out some practical issues for those of you who may be dealing in churches that may be dealing with those who have alcohol and drugs. Thank you, Terry.